Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You're smart, you work hard, and your experience has given you some great ideas that could change the field you work in for the better. What does it take to get people to pay attention? Whether it's fair or not, being very good at what you do is not necessarily enough to get the world to pay attention. But as my guest will explain, you can take concrete steps to build your reputation not only as a skilled and dedicated professional, but as a widely respected thought leader, which can pay dividends to your career and benefit others in your industry. Dori Clark is a marketing and strategy consultant and adjunct professor of business administration at Duke University's School of Business. Her new book is called Stand Out: How to Find Your Breakthrough Idea and Build a Following Around It. Dori, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do we all have it in us to be an expert on something?
I think we actually do. For a lot of people, they hold back and don't even try because they assume that when you talk about being an expert, it means they have to be the world expert in something, one of a handful of people among the 7 billion. But actually, for most people, it's a very reasonable goal to be what I call a local expert. You can be the expert in your company or the expert in your community on a certain issue, and that can provide a really valuable form of career insurance for you.
One really charming example in the book is of Rachel Ray, who would be the first to tell you she is not classically trained as a chef, but she had some skills that actually related to what people wanted to know.
Rachel Ray is a great example of this because she did not go to culinary school. She does not run, you know, one of America's fanciest restaurants. And so a lot of times people look at her and say, what's so special about her? My mom cooks better than her. My wife cooks better than her. But I think the key here is that your expertise really matters in terms of its context. So at the time that Rachel Ray was hired by the Food Network, it was dominated by these professionally trained chefs, the Emeril Lagasses or the Mario Batalis. And regular people might look at them and say, wow, I admire that, but I'm not sure that I can replicate that. I don't know that that my results will be the same as theirs. And so Rachel Ray, while her skills might not seem out of place at a neighborhood potluck, what she brought to the table, being a relatable, everyday kind of person, was actually very distinctive and unique and valuable in the context of the Food Network, and it made her a unique expert.
So what is it that thought leaders tend to have in common? What have they done that is different from the other people who are working in their field?
So thought leadership really contains two pieces at its core, and both of them are equally important. The thought part implies that the person is famous for their ideas. This is not a generic celebrity. This is not a Kardashian that's famous for being famous. This is somebody who has some sort of heft, some, you know, stake to their sizzle. The other part is that they're a leader, and that implies they have to have followers. You can't just be an ivory tower person opining or telling people how they should be doing things, but not actually rolling up your sleeves. A genuine thought leader is someone who is contributing real ideas to the discourse and is actually getting out there and talking about them.
And you're quick to note, this goes back to your point that it's not that everybody has to be a global expert. Most thought leaders are not possessed of some special genius. They have just figured out a way to put disparate elements together and present novel ideas.
It's very true. I mean, you might look at something like Starbucks, which is now completely ubiquitous. Howard Schultz did not invent coffee. He didn't even reinvent the nature of coffee brewing. What he did was he was a keen observer. He went to Italy. He saw how coffee shops operated there and said, wow, we don't have anything like that in the U.S. And so he brought over the Italian sensibility. He made a few tweaks to Americanize it, but created a hybrid that was new, this famous third place. And that became a phenomenon. That was a real contribution. A lot of people just stop themselves and say, well, you know, my idea is already taken or somebody's already doing that. There were millions of coffee shops before Howard Schultz, and still he managed to create an empire and become a billionaire and change business. We can all do this.
Okay, so Dori, people might be listening to this and thinking, well, good for Howard Schultz, but I don't have a big idea. How can we develop the knowledge and skills that we do have into something that is worth sharing?
Well, I think one of the best ways that we can really sort of home in on our own idea, because it is hard to determine it at first, is literally by starting with our own experience. In my book Standout, I tell the story of a woman named Rose Schumann, and she actually found her professional passion when she was 18 years old. Her family had taken a family trip to Nicaragua, where her stepmother was from, and it was her first time in a developing country. It was shortly after the Contra War, and it was just devastated. There was one working streetlight in the entire country. There was poverty everywhere. And she saw that and realized, this is what I want to do. I want to do international development work. I want to help people. And so she ended up studying that in college. She got a job at an NGO after she graduated. And because of her personal interest and background, it positioned her for what later came as her breakthrough idea, which is that she, like a lot of people, had begun thinking about how you bring the internet, the power of the internet, to the world's poor. And one day she was walking around and she saw a call box, kind of like you'd see at a transit station where you push a button and then there's a voice that speaks to you on the other end of the line. And she realized, if you had call boxes in remote rural areas, you wouldn't have to go through all the logistical hurdles of giving laptops to every individual person. They could push a button, connect with someone in a city who could look things up for them, and they could access right away the power of the internet. She did that. It's called Question Box, and today it's operating throughout Africa and India. And really, it's because of her own personal interest and experience.
And one thing that you suggest is that people consider looking at whatever problems they want to solve through a variety of lenses and not necessarily limit their understanding of the world to a focus on what they're doing. In other words, kind of look at different fields and what they're doing, what's happening in music and art and architecture, even if you're trying to solve a problem like how to answer questions in the developing world.
Different fields and using the insights from different fields can be a tremendously valuable exercise, because if you are so steeped in one methodology, it can be very hard to even see that there are other possibilities. In Standout, I write about a guy named Eric Schott, who is today one of the world's leading scientists. And the way that he really got his start and made his mark was that he was one of the first people to bring the power of big data to biology. And the reason he did it, not other people, was that his original training was in mathematics and computer science. And so he was comfortable with quantitative methods in a way that a lot of biologists weren't. He could see things differently. He could see the value of it, and he brought it to bear on some of today's most challenging medical issues, from Alzheimer's to diabetes.
How can we get in the habit of challenging conventional wisdom, or at least looking at the things that everybody assumes are true and won't change, and turning them upside down at least one more time to make sure that that's true?
Well, one question that I advise people to ask themselves is to really probe, is something impossible? Or is it just difficult? Because a lot of times we write something off as, oh, that's never going to happen. That couldn't possibly happen. But the reason it hasn't is that people just have not put in the sustained effort. I write in Standout about Robert Cialdini, who's an eminent psychologist today. And he was really one of the first people to ever do field experiments in psychology. Up until that point, literally almost all psychology experiments were conducted in a college laboratory. And so you didn't really know that they would work in real life with human nature. But he decided that he would do these field experiments where he'd be, for instance, sending out volunteers to go try to fundraise door to door and see what worked and what didn't. He told me it took three times longer to do that than a regular lab experiment. And he had to get the permission of the university and the local police to do it. But he made it happen and he made his name in the field.
And, of course, the data are likely to be much more accurate if they are taken from real-life situations.
Absolutely. You can learn things that other people only guessed at before.
Research can be really helpful to build or bolster a big idea. How do you suggest folks go about it if formal research is not something they've engaged in the past?
So sometimes when people hear the word research, they get a little intimidated because they think they have to be doing bench science or going to the library and writing term papers or something like that. But research can mean a lot of things, and particularly in the professional context, there are a lot of ways to really be adding new insights to your field without having to go back and get a doctorate to do it. I actually profile a guy named Michael Waxenberg in Standout who built up a research really robust and interesting second career for himself. He was an IT manager. He is an IT manager at a financial services company. And his family was trying to decide whether to buy their apartment, which was being turned into a condo. And so he started going to a lot of open houses in New York City where he lived. And he wrote very, very detailed reviews of all of the properties that he visited. And he posted them on a real estate website. And he did this so much and so thoroughly and at such a higher level than anyone else. He actually, after a while, started to get emails coming in saying, I love your reviews. Will you represent me? Will you be my realtor? But he wasn't a realtor. And so the amazing thing was, because he got so many inbound inquiries, an actual realtor finally did contact him and say, look, if you don't have your license yet, I'll sponsor you. You already have a client base. And so Michael became a realtor as a result of this. He doesn't have to do any marketing. All the clients come to him, and he's able to make a great second income for his family.
Dori Clark is my guest. She's a marketing and strategy consultant. She teaches at Duke, and she's the author of the new book, Stand Out, How to Find Your Breakthrough Idea and Build a Following Around It. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Back in 2 minutes with Dori Clark.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with marketing and strategy consultant Dori Clark. Her new book is called Stand Out, How to Find Your Breakthrough Idea and Build a Following Around It. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. That's where we hear Dori from Leah, who says, I'm a paraprofessional in a field dominated by those with master's degrees. How can I try to create buzz around my big ideas?
That's a terrific question. And I think that in a lot of cases, people are held back because they are perceiving themselves as lacking something that other people have. If you have a lot of master's degrees around you and you're a paraprofessional, sometimes people might think, well, you know, what can I contribute? Or are other people going to judge me because of not having that degree? Ultimately, one of the things that I discovered in the course of researching more than 50 top thought leaders for Stand Out is that educational credentials actually matter very little. What you need to do is make sure that you're bringing new value and different value into a context. And so if there are 99 engineers in an organization and you are the 100th, it's probably not going to make that much of a difference because you all see the world the same way. But if there are 99 engineers or 99 attorneys or whatever type of field you're working in, you have a different experience to bring that actually can help illuminate things. So it's not about shying away from the fact that you don't have this thing that they have. It's actually about reframing it because you have something they don't have. In my first book, Reinventing You, I actually profiled a woman named Libby Wagner, who was a poet who became a management consultant, which is a pretty rare transition to make. And at first, she was really embarrassed. She was really nervous and thought maybe she should go get her MBA. She wasn't sure that people would take her seriously. But what she came to realize was that her clients fundamentally cared about results. And because she had studied as a poet, she had something the MBAs did not, which is that she had spent a number of years closely understanding and analyzing the nuances of language. And so if you're a CEO and you're looking to communicate sensitive messages to your customers, your stakeholders, or your employees, it actually might pay to hire the poet who can help you craft your language rather than an MBA who has a cursory understanding of that. So it's about understanding those differences and not thinking so much about what they have and you don't, but about what you have that you can bring to them.
And it is important, you stress, that we really care about this thing. So if we find a niche, that's great, but it needs to be something that we have some passion around.
Absolutely. Passion is a key ingredient. I mean, we all know passion can't be the only ingredient. Etsy recently went public, the online craft vendor, and you know, there are plenty of people that are very passionate about you know, making fruitcakes or knitting scarves, and the world is not equally passionate about it. But that being said, if you can be strategic about finding an area that you really care about that also offers value to other people and that other people seem excited about too, that's the sweet spot. That's the place that you should go. What I discovered in the course of researching the book was that ultimately the most successful ideas, the ones that go viral, the common denominator that they have is that almost from their inception, they have the potential to go viral because the idea is not just about the person who creates it. The idea is relevant to and about other people. Lean In could have sold decently if it was just a book about Sheryl Sandberg and her life and how she got to be a famous executive. But she has tried very hard to make the Lean In message one that is bigger than her and is about women's empowerment more broadly and about the importance of women asking for what they want and having tough conversations. That message resonates, and that's why Lean In circles have started around the world.
And I guess also in terms of going viral, analyzing what has already happened can be very interesting, but the real value is often in looking at what today's trends predict about what's ahead.
Absolutely. I interviewed a woman named Deb Mills Schofield, who's an innovation expert at Brown and Oberlin, and she actually raised a really interesting point. This is something I actually discuss in an ebook that I have that's coming out in June called Standout Networking. And what she talks about when it comes to building your network is the fact that today's successful people, you know, the influencers today, are actually to a certain extent lagging indicators. We might all think it's the coolest thing in the world to if we get to have dinner with Richard Branson or if we get to be best friends with Sheryl Sandberg or Larry Page or Sergey Brin or whatever. But those are today's celebrities. If you really want to be on the pulse of what's happening in the future, you actually need to get more creative. You need to look out at the periphery. You need to say, who's coming up? Who are, you could say, you know, the quote-unquote B-list or C-list today of people who are making their move, and what are they doing? And if you're creative about watching that and connecting with those people, then you can really see what's coming 5 years down the road.
You also talk about connecting people who are interested in your ideas to one another. Now, it's clear, Dory, how that might benefit them. What's the upside for the people who are doing the connecting?
The biggest upside is that you can only be in one place at one time. And so if you are the only one who is talking about your idea, ultimately your idea is going to peter out. There's only so much one person can do. But if other people get excited about it, if they become your ambassadors for it, then it can grow exponentially. In Standout, I talk about a guy named Eric Ries, who wrote a best-selling book a few years ago called The Lean Startup. This has really become a phenomenon in Silicon Valley and has reshaped how a lot of tech entrepreneurs think about their business. But what's really interesting today, it spawned this culture of lean startup meetup groups. And as of you know, a few weeks ago, there were more than 750,000 people around the world who were registered for lean startup meetups in 84 different countries. Eric Ries himself could never go to all those places, but these are people that are motivated enough that they're literally choosing to organize and congregate on their own to discuss the ideas in the book.
So as people have formed their good ideas, they feel like they've really got something that is worth sharing. How do you get the word out there when you can't just necessarily call up the nearest media outlet and say, hey, I've got a great idea? Because I can tell you from experience, people may or may not have time to even listen to that.
Sure. When it comes to building a following around your idea, there's really a three-step process that I discovered in Standout. And that is, first, you have to build your network. Second, you need to build your audience. And third, you build your community. And basically what this means, this first step of building your network, is about getting the people closest to you on board. You already have a network, hopefully, of trusted advisors, people that you can bounce ideas off of. You want to talk to them, refine your ideas, get them to be in as good a shape as possible before the world sees them. Get some honest feedback. Next, you build your audience, which is the more conventional marketing activities. It's blogging, it's speaking, it's talking to journalists so that other people can hear about and discover your idea. And then finally, it's that third point, the apex, where your community starts talking to each other and your idea takes on a life of its own.
When people are starting a blog, talk about how we can decide what to write about and how to structure this. You know, people who haven't done it before might struggle to, you know, with whether they should give that all away on the blog or whether they should save it for a book that they're planning to write someday. How do you make those choices?
Well, the good news is that I think the era of needing to hold things back, you know, I don't want people to know about my idea. I think that's really past. Ideas are cheap. They're plentiful. Everybody has ideas. The best way to actually get recognized for an idea is not to hide it and then try to patent it or whatever. I mean, maybe that's the case if you're a scientist that's literally creating a new device the world has never seen before. But if you're writing or talking about a general idea, the best way to really get credit for it in the public sphere is to share it as widely as possible so that anytime someone else hears it, they think, oh, you know, Joe was the person who said that. You want to come up. If someone now decided that they wanted to write a book and they would call it Lean In, everyone would be like, are you crazy? That's Sheryl Sandberg's book. Why are you doing that? She's been successful enough that she now owns that. So in terms of what to create for blog posts or how to create this content, I actually like to start literally with just the questions that people ask you. If you're at a cocktail party, what do they want to know? What do they ask you about your field? Are there trends that people are interested in or trends that you see that other people might not? Are there misconceptions about your field? What technologies or apps are interesting or reshaping your field? All of those things are pretty valuable and good starting places for content. You want to think, what is a question that people have and how can I answer that?
Marketing and strategy consultant Dori Clark is my guest. She teaches business administration at Duke University, and she's the author of a new book called Stand Out, How to Find Your Breakthrough Idea and Build a Following Around It. We'll talk with Dori again in a few minutes. If you'd like to join that conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back with Dori Clark in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is marketing and strategy consultant Dori Clark. She teaches business administration at Duke University, and she has just published a book called Stand Out, How to Find Your Breakthrough Idea and Build a Following Around It. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Dori, what do you say to people who are afraid that they, in promoting their big idea, in trying to get the word out, they will come across like shameless self-promoters?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern about that among many people. I mean, Americans, this is something I've actually written about for the Harvard Business Review with my colleague Andy Malinsky. Worldwide, Americans have the most bullish attitude toward self-promotion of any culture. But that being said, there's still a lot of individual variation amongst Americans about what's appropriate and what's not. I know certainly over the past few weeks as I've been marketing my book launch, you know, you have to thread the needle carefully. with people that you email and all kinds of things. But ultimately, if you keep a couple of principles in mind, it can be helpful. The first one is making sure that that you actually think about utility for the other person. So, you know, buy my book, it can come off as being too much self-promotion, or, you know, give me money for my startup or fund my Kickstarter campaign, or anything along those lines. However, if you're targeting your message to people who you genuinely believe can benefit from it, it is less like an imposition and more like a collaboration. If you really think that the product or service you're creating is of value, then all of a sudden you have to reframe it for yourself, but also it gets reframed for the other person as well. I mean, we all have probably felt pretty good if we recommend something to our friends, you know, like a clothing store or a housekeeping service or whatever, and they really like it. And so similarly, the first goal is to reframe it for yourself so that you understand you're not just spamming everyone. If you believe in what you're doing, if you believe your idea benefits other people and can help them, then that's a valued and valuable thing to do. The other strategy is to actually get a wingman to help promote you. This is something that can be very collaborative. This is based on the research of Robert Cialdini and Jeffrey Pfeffer, two organizational psychologists. They said that if research has shown if you're talking about how great you are all the time, people are going to tune out. They won't listen. But if a friend, you know, or if some colleague of yours is saying literally those exact same things about you, people will perk up and listen and will think you're great. So if you make a pact, a wingman pact with your friend, this can be very powerful.
You stress that it's okay and in many cases even necessary to find a way to make money as a thought leader. For most of us, it's not economically sustainable to just give this stuff away forever.
It's true. And one of the things that is, I think, most fascinating and sometimes troubling about the new economy is that the ways that people make money have changed over time. A lot of the things that I wanted to do when I was a teenager are really no longer good ways to make money. I wanted to be a journalist, and in fact, I started my career as a print journalist. No offense, and I lost my job. I got laid off a year into my career. I was in my early 20s, and I had to find something else to do. Today, I am kind of a journalist. I write regularly for Forbes, for the Harvard Business Review, for Entrepreneur. I'm doing these pieces, but in most cases, I'm not getting paid for them. I'm monetizing through the side door, essentially, through speaking and consulting. So you can still do the things you love, but you have to get just a little bit more creative about how you make money off of them.
And it's important, you say, not to charge too little for your services once you're working in some kind of consulting function.
Yes, absolutely. One interesting finding that the research backs up again and again is the fact that for services where it's difficult to make an apples-to-apples comparison, people oftentimes impute value to it based on what the sticker price is. So if someone was trying to sell you paper towels for $25 a piece, you'd say, that's ridiculous. I know what paper towels cost. You're ludicrous. But if I'm trying to sell you a consulting service and or, you know, giving a speech, and one person is $500 and the other person is $5,000 or $50,000, you look at that and you say, I wonder why they're charging that. They must be worth it. And because you really don't know, you look at that and say, I have to evaluate this. If other people are paying $50,000, he's pretty good or she's got to be pretty good. So you never want to underprice yourself because it automatically means for the consumer that they're going to be devaluing whatever you do, whether it is great or not, because of that perception up front.
Sometimes people would really like to connect with someone who's quite prominent in their industry, and they realize that it is probably not going to happen if they just, you know, send an email and say, can I take you to lunch someday? One thing that you have found works for some people who have these sort of professional blogs where they write about their ideas is asking these individuals if they can interview them.
Yes, I profile and stand out a guy named John Corcoran, who is an attorney in the Bay Area. And he has done this with great success. He has a podcast and a blog, and he wanted to connect with very prominent business authors. And he was strategic about it. He found out when they had books coming out, and so therefore when they would be eager to get publicity. And he timed his requests. And as a result, he's been able to make connections and have conversations with a huge array of pretty famous people in his field. And as a result of that, he's been very good about turning this one-time, one-hour conversation into an actual relationship where you follow up and get to know each other better over time. But interviews are always going to go to the front of the line when it comes to requests from strangers. Can I pick your brain? That's going to be in the back of the line. So if you really want to meet people, you've got to be strategic about it.
What else do you suggest to people who are trying still to cultivate their big idea or figure out exactly how to articulate it in terms of how we should be educating ourselves about the rest of the field?
Well, one of the things that you can do is to really make sure that you are surveying the options of what's in the field presently. In order to come up with a big idea, fundamentally, it's about looking for holes. What isn't being said? What isn't being talked about? What assumptions are everyone else making, but that may not actually be true or may not be true anymore? And so if you are looking for inspiration, what I would suggest is a very early starting point is to read extensively, read all the canonical works in your field where you want to make a mark. And as you're doing so, take a look at it and see, okay, the discourse has been focused on X, Y, and Z, but what about this? And if you can discover where the holes are, that very likely is where you can make a contribution.
What would you say the time investment in this is to become a thought leader, sort of aside from what we're already doing to make a living in whatever this field might be?
Well, I have two answers for that. The first one is David Allen of Getting Things Done fame, the productivity guru, who's someone that I write about in the book. I interviewed him, and he had a great quote, which is, you don't need time to have a great idea. You need space. And for far too few of us, we just don't have the mental space to have ideas because we're so highly scheduled. We're just back to back running around, trying desperately to get to that meeting or to clear out our inbox. And it doesn't leave you time for the kind of big picture associative thinking that you need to come up with a big idea. So on one hand, it doesn't actually take a lot of time. That being said, for instance, Rose Shuman, who I mentioned earlier, who had the great idea about Question Box to help bring the internet to the developing world, she came up with that idea over a four-hour period. She got an inspiration. She spent 4 hours that day writing down the idea. But then it's taken her the next decade. Literally, it's been a decade worth of work to implement that idea. So that's the piece that is less sexy, but really is what enables it to succeed in the culture, is that you can have your idea, but you need to work at it and work at spreading it.
Dori Clark is a marketing and strategy consultant. She teaches business administration at Duke, and she's the author of a new book called Stand Out, How to Find Your Breakthrough Idea and Build a Following Around It. Dori, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. We really appreciate it that you come with us for every conversation or every conversation that you can listen to during your busy day or your busy evening if you listen to the podcast or the rebroadcast. We are glad that you are part of the audience. We really appreciate it.